And yo, what is a cipher?
The most exhausting, nerve-wracking experience in the world.
The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cipher come from?
The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher, a weekly podcast bringing you talks with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This is episode 205, a talk with Ernest Dickerson. Ernest is a director, cinematographer, and writer who has played a key role in some of the best and most important film and television of the past four decades. Ernest got his start in the mid-1980s as the cinematographer on movies by his NYU film school pal, Spike Lee. Ernest shot every one of Spike's movies up through 1992's Malcolm X, a historic run that included She's Gotta Have It, Do the Right Thing, and Jungle Fever, just to name a few. Ernest struck out on his own with a hip-hop cinema classic, 1992's Juice. The film, about four Harlem teenagers who slowly get dragged into a perilous situation, featured Tupac Shakur in his first starring film role, and also had cameos from hip-hop figures of the time like Tretch, Queen Latifah, Red Alert, and Yo MTV Raps hosts Fab Five Freddy, Ed Lover, and Dr. Dre. A 25th anniversary edition of the movie, with tons of never-before-seen extras, including an alternate ending, is available now. But that's not nearly all of Ernest Dickerson's story. He has directed other great films like Surviving the Game, Demon Knight, and the Snoop Dogg starring Bones, and he has helmed notable episodes of great TV series like The Wire and The Walking Dead. His latest project, out now on the festival circuit, is Double Play, a film produced by our episode 92 guest, Lisa Cortez. We talked to Ernest via Skype from his home in California. If you like the show, please check out our Patreon at patreon.com/thecyphershow. It helps us keep the lights on, and we've recently updated our rewards with some crazy new stuff. If you want to know any of the media we're playing during this episode, visit thecyphershow.com to find a complete list and the show notes. While you're there, sign up for our monthly newsletter to stay on top of what's going on with The Cipher. And now, here's the man who's got the juice now, Ernest Dickerson. So thank you for agreeing to do this. I'm really very excited to talk to you. And actually, when I got here today, Josh was even more excited when he found out you directed Surviving the Game, which is a movie he completely, really loves.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Never underestimate.
Come on, Mason!
A man who has nothing to lose. Rutger Hauer. Charles Dutton. Gary Busey. F. Murray Abraham. William McNamara. And Ice-T. Surviving the Game.
Bang!
Directed by Ernest Dickerson.
Do you have any particular memories of making that stand out to you now?
Oh, man. Yeah, like major. One of them was that 4 days into shooting, F. Murray Abraham was in a really bad car accident. We were shooting in Wenatchee, Washington, which is on the other side of the Cascade Mountains, about 4 hours away from Seattle. And the major locations were about an hour away from the hotel where everybody was staying. And so normally everybody would be driven to the locations. But one night, you know, we started shooting with the stuff with the guys in the cabin, the dinner in the cabin.
Mm-hmm.
Observe your food. Smell it. Touch it. Put your mind into it. And then when you're finally ready, consume it slowly.
You do it your way, I do mine.
And that was, I think, about 3 or 4 days. And one night, Murray decided he was going to drive himself home for whatever reason. And those roads are dark, really dark at night. I mean, there's no street lamps. It's the mountains, it's country. It's just dark, black roads outside your headlights. And he was driving down the road, and he said all of a sudden he had an impression of a flash of green out of the right side of his eye, and bam, something hit his car, spun him on the other side of the road. Now, normally, if he would have been driven, he would have been sitting in the passenger side.
Right.
But this night he was driving, so he was on the side opposite where the impact hit. And that probably saved his life because his car spun over to the other side of the road, his face went into the steering wheel. He dinged it into the steering wheel. He broke 3 ribs, broke a hand. The driver in the other car was killed. There were 2 other people that had to be in the car. They found that they had beer bottles and liquor bottles all in the car. So it was drunk driving and going through a stop sign. And Murray had to go to the hospital.
How far away was the hospital from where you guys were?
I think it was pretty far. I think it was, I think he had to be helicoptered out also.
Right.
So he goes to the hospital. And so we had to shoot around him. So when you watch the movie, there in the beginning of the film, when they first start the hunt, you'll notice there are times when Murray doesn't really say anything. His character doesn't say anything. He's always kind of like in the back and he has his goggles down. Well, that was actually his stunt double. Because we couldn't stop shooting, we had to go on. And, that was the best thing I could do because we had already started the hunt or them getting on their ATVs and going after Ice-T. So Murray was in the hospital for like 4 days. And his agent was telling him, well, don't go back to work. I'm sure insurance will take care of it. And Murray said, nah, man, I need to be working because if I sit still, I'll be thinking about what almost just happened to me. That I almost died.
Right.
So after 4 days, he came back to work. But he was heavily drugged. He had his hand in a cast. His right hand was in a cast. And so that's why his character wears black gloves throughout the rest of the hunt, because we had to hide that cast. And it was, I love Murray, man. He was great. He was a real trooper. He would come in. He could only do maybe a couple of takes and then he'd have to sit down and rest. But he was determined to work. And the cast of that film was really, really, really great. I love Rutger Hauer. Everybody told me, watch out for Rutger. He could be a real handful. But Rutger and I were like totally cool. And so Murray wanted to thank the crew for being so patient with him. Mm-hmm. So he bought out a restaurant and gave a party. And the only requirement for getting in the party is you had to wear something red. So everybody was coming out with red handkerchiefs or red ties or red shirts, whatever. Rutger had the most creative solution. He had at least 1 or 2, maybe 3 young ladies with red lipstick kiss him all over his face. So he showed up with red lipstick all over his face, which is a pretty creative solution.
Yeah.
So that was a major thing. There were a lot of problems with that film. When I scouted the locations, the rivers were raging and we were going to put Ice-T in the river and have him, fighting the rapids and everything. And when we scouted it, it was ideal. Well, in the couple of months from location scouting to actual shooting, because there had been a record low snowfall that winter, the rivers were not raging by the time we got there.
Oh, no.
So it was like, how do you make a non-raging river rage on a movie that's, still a low budget film? It was a low budget movie. So we wound up having to use 3 separate rivers and piece it all together, and just try and do it that way. So, it was a lot of interesting stuff that happened on that shoot, man. I mean, just the idea that every day when I, we're shooting up in the woods, and every day when I would show up for work, the set dressers would have gone in before we did and killed the rattlesnakes that were up there. So by the time I got there, there were usually about 4 or 5 dead rattlesnakes already laid out. And when we were shooting, we had a security guard who would sit in a high position, mm-hmm, with his rifle ready to shoot any snakes that came our way. So it was real interesting. I could go on for hours about what that was like.
Sure.
The shooting.
Yeah. And the central sort of thing in the film, right, Ice-T sort of being hunted. Unfortunately, what that says about race, about whiteness, about America is more relevant, if anything, today than it was in 1994.
Yeah. I mean, it's the ultimate white privilege, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, it was great. I mean, actually, when we got up there, we tried to bring in the police to provide security for us, but that was not long after Cop Killer had come out.
Cop Killer!
To hear more about the controversy around Cop Killer, check out episode 131 with Ice-T's then-girlfriend Darlene Ortiz. Also listen to episode 136 with Paris and episode 171 with Tommy Boy Records' Monica Lynch, who dealt with the fallout from an artist and label president's perspective, respectively.
So the police pretty much boycotted us because of Ice-T. So, you know, we wound up having to hire an independent private security guy who also turned out to be a really, really interesting individual. But Jeff Corey, who played his older friend in what was supposed to be Seattle.
I'm hungry, goddammit. I can tell you that.
You gotta eat soon, man.
I mean, look at this stuff. People are becoming goddamn rabbits. Goddamn. People don't eat meat anymore.
We gotta get something to eat.
Nothing you can chew on.
All that complaining ain't making sense.
Jeff Corey is an old actor who had been in movies since the 40s. We've seen his face. He has like a real owl-like face, and he's been in so many movies.
A small sampling of the movies Jeff Corey was in from 1938 until his death in 2002 includes The Devil and Daniel Webster, Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, Miracle on 34th Street, In Cold Blood, Beneath the Planet of the Apes, and Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
But as soon as Ice-T got there and Jeff Corey got there, I took them out to dinner. And what was amazing is that Jeff Corey in the 50s was prevented from working because of the House of Un-American Activities Committee. He was blacklisted. Wow. And so Ice-T being blacklisted, they bonded like crazy, you know, because they had both gone through being blacklisted for, you know, for their political beliefs. And, you know, so they were an right. interesting combination.
That's amazing. And so as someone who is from New Jersey,
hey,
it is
homeboys.
Yeah, it is legally required for me to ask you what it was like to shoot the Born in the USA video.
It was great, man. I was, you know, honored to be asked to do it. And, you know, we shot it documentary style, and we basically, you know, drove around to different factories, you know, and shooting people at work. But then we had to fly out to L.A. That's when I was still living in New York. So we flew out here to L.A. Mm-hmm. To shoot the concert, which was amazing. And then the final shot we did in the backyard of Bruce's producer, where had the flag on the wall. And we actually hung it on his garage, and Bruce walks in and looks over his shoulder.
Wow.
Bruce,
yeah, that's the shot where you recreate the Born in the USA album cover, where he like has the jeans on and he's standing backwards.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We just did that in his producer's driveway. It was cool, man. You know, Bruce was very, very, very cool. I was surprised at how almost shy he was. He was really a very soft-spoken, really cool guy, but you know, that those were in the days when Clarence Clemons was still playing sax for him, man. Clarence was totally cool.
Yeah.
Clarence was cool. And I had a chance to direct him years later because he did a little bit on The Wire. He came in for several days on The Wire, and I had a chance to work with him.
I have the microphone, ma'am.
Let the woman speak.
My kids, they can't play outside no more.
Did he remember the video shoot?
I'm not sure if he did because, you know, a lot of water under the bridge.
Sure.
You know, they go through so much stuff.
Right.
But it was just good. I mean, you know, it's too bad he left us so soon.
Of course. That video was shot by John Sayles, who you shot your first professional movie for, Brother from Another Planet.
It's John Sayles' dazzling and propelling comedy hit. It's the box office blast guaranteed to open your eyes.
The Brother from Another Planet. Yeah.
Yeah, I just done Brother.
Yeah.
John asked me to do Born in the USA. So it was cool because I had only been to L.A. once before, so years earlier. So it was interesting coming out to Los Angeles and experiencing it.
Yeah. What about Brother from Another Planet? That's such an interesting movie because Joe Morton, who we now know as a guy on Scandal who talks all the time.
For you, it's always summertime and the living is easy. Daddy's rich. Mama's good looking. You're a grand.
Mm-hmm. Hardly says a word through most of that film.
He doesn't say anything.
Yeah.
Yeah, that really shocked me too when because I think the next time I saw Joe after doing Brother was in the movie Taps, and it was so weird to see him speaking.
Incredible balance. What was that you were, Maxwell? Juggler, acrobat?
Tap dancer.
Yeah, tap dance. I love that shit.
You know, Brother was my first film, and my first film as a cinematographer. What happened was that I had photographed Spike Lee's graduate thesis film because we were at NYU together.
Mm-hmm. This was the Joe's Bed-Stuy, We Cut Heads.
Yeah, I shot Joe's Bed-Stuy Barbershop.
Mm-hmm. Hey, did you vote?
No, I don't waste my time voting.
Guess don't make much difference, man. Hey, you think Veganomics is bad? 4 more years of Kacha ain't exactly no picnic, you know?
Hard Times for Soul.
And it actually premiered at the New Films New Director Series in New York. And John Sayles saw it. And because of that, that's why, you know, he contacted me. I'm at home. I had been married for several months, and my wife had just told me that she was going to have a baby. And I had been shooting occasional music videos. I'd been doing a series of shooting some films for the public relations films for the Archdiocese of Brooklyn. And, you know, I'm figuring, wow, I got a baby on the way. We got to have a regular income. What am I going to do? I mean, I want to get into the Cinematographers Union, but we got to do something to support ourselves, you know, until that happens. So I figured, okay, well, maybe if I drove a cab, that will give me the flexibility to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I was preparing to try and get my cab driver's medallion in New York. And then I got this phone call, and it was a young lady named Peggy Roschke, who was the production supervisor. She says, hi, I don't know if you know me. I don't know if you've ever heard of John Sayles. I said, yeah, I know John Sayles. Because he was the independent filmmaker at that time.
Right.
And she says he's preparing to do a kind of like Roger Corman-esque science fiction film called The Brother Who Fell to Earth. That was the original title. And he'd like to talk to you. So I went in and met with him, had a great conversation with John. He had not written a word of script, but he yet.
Yeah.
But he told me the whole movie. He actually told me the story of the movie all the way through. And, you know, he was getting ready to shoot in Harlem. So I think having a significant African-American presence on his crew was of paramount importance to him. And he asked me if I'd ever shot 35.
You lied and said yes, right?
I lied and said yes, you know, because I knew I could do it. I had already assisted on some 35 millimeter shoots in film school. So it's just the difference in the film size, the exposure mechanics and the photochemistry. It's all the same.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't worried about that. And he says, okay, let me think about it. And they said they wanted to go with me. And 2 weeks later, he had a complete script. And we shot it in 24 days, if I remember correctly. 24, 25 days. And my first one out, it was real interesting.
Yeah, I'll bet. And you mentioned music videos in there, and in that last answer, doing music videos. I saw a music video that you shot on spec with Spike for White Lines, featuring mm-hmm. a very young and very well dancing Larry Fishburne.
We'll have a link to the video in the show notes for this episode.
What do you remember about making that one?
Yeah, well, you know, Spike and I were trying to figure out how are we going to break into the industry? How are we going to, you know, do videos? And we knew that the company that produced the song White Lines was in Jersey. I forget her name. I think her first name was Sylvia.
Yeah, Sylvia Robinson, yeah.
Bass.
Sylvia Robinson co-founded Sugar Hill Records, headquartered in Englewood, New Jersey, with her husband Joe and Milton Malden. Among their most popular acts was Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five, though due to legal issues and group infighting, their 1983 hit song White Lines Don't Do It was credited to Grandmaster and Melly Mel. Sugar Hill Records closed down in 1986.
Yeah. And so Spike decided to, you know, just try and shoot it on spec and see what happens. And we had met Lawrence, Larry, we could call him Larry back then. You can't call him that now.
Right.
We met Lawrence, you know, out at NYU. He would come through and we were just, you know, we were starstruck by him because he'd been in Apocalypse Now, you know, years earlier than that. He'd been in Cornbread Earl and Me. You know, he was like a real actor. And so we brought him in and we got some dancers who were from the dance department at NYU and did this video in a couple of days. And actually, that's where Lawrence met the lady who would be his first wife.
Wow.
You know, she was one of the dancers. And we shot it and Spike edited it and he submitted, he sent it to, you know, he was hoping to get airplay. And so he sent it to that company, he sent it to Sylvia's company. And we never heard anything from him. We never heard anything from him. And it was like, okay, life goes on. And one night I was like flipping channels. And I remember there used to be a show called Night Flight that used to show music videos.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just flipping channels one night at home. This is a couple of years later. And what's on but our White Lines video? And I called Spike about it. And he was understandably incensed, and I was incensed. But I think by that time, that company had gone, I think they had gone belly up. And I guess they just raided their library for whatever they had and put it on Night Flight. So, yeah, that's how that happened.
Amazing. There was so much stuff that you did with Spike. But one thing, I was rewatching some of it, and School Days, something about School Days struck me, right? It's a film set at a black college with Kadeem Hardison and Daryl Bell and Jasmine Guy. Mm-hmm. And right around the same time, there's a sitcom set at a black college starring Kadeem Hardison, Daryl Bell, and Jasmine Guy.
It's a different world.
What was the connection?
It came after.
Right, I figured.
The TV show came after School Days.
Yeah.
School Days was first. I don't know what the connection was. I don't know if they, you know, that's an interesting question. I should ask Spike about that, because it did come out afterwards, and they did get some of our same people. And, you know, there weren't that many dramas being done that were centered around black universities. So I don't know. Maybe did we inspire that show? Maybe. I don't know. I've always wondered about that.
Yeah, it's a reasonable thing to wonder about. How did you first come across Kadeem? Because you used him a couple times, including in Death by Temptation.
Yeah, well, what happened was that I first met Kadeem when I was shooting, this was right before School Days, and I was shooting an old a movie called Enemy Territory. It was an exploitation company. I think it was run by Charles Band Productions. I'm trying to remember the names of these things. But anyway, it's a movie called Enemy Territory. And Kadeem actually played one of the young gangsters in it.
Check this shit out. Where the fuck is it count? Where the fuck is it count? People dead, shot up, cut up, and I don't see them nowhere around, man. Yo, Marcus said that Psycho was gone. What?
It was a movie that was set in a housing project, and it starred Ray Parker Jr. and the guy who had been in, there was a TV series, was it Family or something?
Gary Frank, who starred in Enemy Territory, played Willie Lawrence on the TV series Family from 1976 to 1980.
It was also the first film for Stacey Dash.
Wow.
Yeah, she was like 17 years old, you know, young, pretty lady playing this really tough young Project Living Chick.
Parker, please, we need your help. These men are on the run from the vampires. Please.
Oh, yeah? Look like you're standing up to me.
Mr. Parker, please. You're the only one they're afraid of.
Oh, really?
So Kadeem was one of the gangsters, and we just started talking one night. And he said, hey, man, I'm getting ready to do Spike's movie. And, you know, I know I was scheduled to go do School Days, but he told me he was going to do it. So that was the first time we met. And then we go to Atlanta and we shoot School Days, and he's there. James Bond III, who was one of Lawrence Fishburne's cohorts in the film, he decided years later he wanted to do Death by Temptation. And so he and Kadeem were friends. And so James bought him on to star in the film, play his best friend, and me to shoot it. So that's how that happened.
Yeah.
And then I used Kadeem years later in a TV movie that I did for Showtime called Blind
Hey,
Faith.
John, how you doing, man?
Good.
Wow. Anna, you looking beautiful as always?
Yeah, you're looking kind of skinny there, Eddie.
Aww.
Come on, you getting that food down there in Greenwich Village?
No. First of all, it's pronounced Greenwich.
Aww.
All right, you got to get a little dip in your hip when you
dip
say
my
that.
Dip hip?
Yeah.
He's getting hip now.
I always been hip, girl.
And, you know, he's good. He's one of those actors who, you know, we haven't seen enough of him. I mean, I don't know what he's been doing recently, but I haven't seen him in a while.
Kadeem is actually still acting and is currently playing the role of Zendaya's father in the Disney Channel show Casey Undercover.
I was going to ask about that. Do you think that maybe having, you know, sometimes if you have a part on a long-running sitcom, that can have a downside and that people only see you one way?
I don't know. I wonder.
Mm-hmm.
When he was in Blind Faith, he did a really good job. Blind Faith did get limited theatrical release, so people had a chance to see him in a dramatic role, playing the jazz musician brother of Courtney Vance and Charles Dutton.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's you never know what forces affect somebody's career. You know, a lot of times it comes down to bad management. You know, bad agents who are just not able to get you in to mm-hmm. certain places, or I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. It's a strange business.
Sure. And School Days has these dance numbers, musical numbers. Had you filmed anything on that kind of scale before that movie? That was only maybe third movie or something by that point. It was pretty early on in your career.
Nothing that big yet. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we were determined that we weren't going to do the dance numbers using the flash dance method.
Of quick cuts and stuff.
Yeah, quick cuts, you know, quick shots of the body. Because, you know, Spike, quiet as it's been kept, was a real fan of MGM musicals. His mother used to take him to see MGM musicals in the movies when he was a kid. So he's pretty well versed in the films of Vincent Minnelli and stuff like that.
Me in St. Louis, Louis, meet me at the fair. Don't tell me the lights are shining any place but there. We will dance the hoochie coochie. I will be your tootsie wootsie.
You know, believe it or not.
Yeah.
But, you know, just a real film lover. But the idea that we wanted to treat the dance the way dance had traditionally been photographed, where it's all about the full body and it's about the positive and the negative space, how the full body is going to fit into the proscenium, or in our case, the frame. Mm. And so that's why we had the big wide shots with the dancers going, because we were trying to go back to that that classical way of showing dance, which I think is more respectful to the art itself, because dance is about the human body. It is about the form. It's about the movement. And if you break that up in editing, you know, you lose all that. So we were determined to go back to the classic style. And, you know, there was one set that was a real, real, real hard job to shoot. That's I think it was the song Good and Bad Hair, where the girls were in like a hairstylist place. We did a real stylized
book. Yeah, that's the big early dance number. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was those mirrors on the wall that were a major, major problem, because I was operating as well as lighting the film. So it was complex. It was very complicated. School Days was a tough shoot, because, you know, we had scouted a lot of locations at Morehouse and Spelman, and the look of the film was pretty much set in these beautiful rolling landscapes, these places we had found. The problem was that the schools wanted script approval.
Ooh.
And, you know, because they were worried, because She's Gotta Have It had sex mm-hmm. in it. And they were worried that this movie was going to be what they were calling a typical Spike Lee film, which there was no such thing at that time.
There was one movie.
I know. And so Spike refused. You know, they wanted to make sure that there were no sex and drugs in the film, and Spike wasn't going to give them script approval. So about a week before we started shooting, or maybe even less, we lost, I'd say, about 90% of our locations. And so, you know, locations have to be prepared in order to help me light. You know, there are only certain colors that you want on the walls. You don't like white walls, or the white walls are all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And so it became a bit of a race, because it was like, well, where can we shoot this scene? Well, where can we shoot this scene? Well, we lost this location. Where can we shoot this scene? And a lot of times I didn't see some of the locations until we actually went in to start lighting it and setting up to shoot. So having lost all of our locations was really rough. And then the schools also laid down the rule that they told Spike, if we see 1 inch of any of our property in your film, we're going to sue you. We're going to sue your ass.
Wow.
And Atlanta University was still allowing us to shoot there. But what's right across the street from Atlanta University? Morehouse.
Right.
You know, it's right there. So so that really determined my camera angles. I had to either shoot away or being high looking down, or low looking up. So I didn't see any of the Morehouse real estate in the background. So it was tough. And Atlanta is a difficult place because of the weather changes, the humidity. It got really, really cold at night, you know. That was reinforced for me years later when I was there doing Walking Dead,
of course. Yeah.
It's a rough place to shoot, but we got it done.
I was curious about one thing that kind of stumbled across, which is before She's Gotta Have It, you guys were going to do something called The Messenger that was going to be a lot more expensive and a lot more elaborate, and that kind of fell apart, leading to She's Gotta Have It. What was The Messenger?
The Messenger was actually kind of a semi-autobiographical film that Spike had written, and I wasn't going to be able to do The Messenger because his schedule conflicted with something else that I was doing. I think it might have been Crush Group.
Hey, check out the stars. Sheila E., Run DMC, The Fat Boys.
Yeah, The Fat Boys!
And Curtis Blow.
Because it was that same year. He was going to do The Messenger, and then the money fell through at the last minute. Mm. And Spike didn't want to be sitting around waiting to get more money. He said it would take a couple of years to get the money. He didn't want to be sitting around waiting. He was ready to go. And so he wrote She's Gotta Have It, I think, in a couple of weeks. You know, and he wrote it as a film that he could do with very little money, that he could shoot basically in the neighborhood. That's what it was. We shot it in 12 days. It was all, you know, the one van that we had was we got from Rent-A-Wreck. All the camera equipment and lighting equipment we got on deferred, you know, from the goodwill we had built up with the facilities that kept the upkeep of the NYU cameras.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were both, you know, Spike and I worked in the, you know, we had part-time jobs working in the equipment room. And it was this company called Technological Cine Video Services that would service the cameras. You know, they would fix them and do updates to them and things like that. And so we knew the owner of that place really well, and we had good credit there. And so they gave us the cameras on deferred payment, and everything was deferred. So it really worked out. I mean, the fact that the Messenger fell through was good for me because, you know, I was able to work with him.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when he rescheduled, by that time, Crush Groove was over,
mm-hmm.
and Crush Groove was my first union film.
Oh, wow.
So it was kind of a big thing for me.
You were the only black member of the union. Is that right?
No, not the union.
Oh, so American Cinematographer.
Yeah, the ASC. Yeah.
That's the ASC, the American Society of Cinematographers. Ernest joined in 1990, and by the time the New York Times was profiling him 3 years later, he was still the only black member.
No, there were some other black members in the union. There was not that many, though. There was a guy named Leroy Patton, who I found out about when Ebony Magazine did a story on he and his wife being some of the first African-American people to join the Cameramen's Union in New York. And Joe Wilcox in L.A. But by that time, you know, it wasn't all one union. You had your L.A. local, you had your New York local. And, you know, normally L.A. guys, New York guys could not go to L.A. and shoot, but L.A. guys could come to New York and shoot. So it was, you know, the rules back in those days were kind of crazy.
Yeah. I have to ask you, you know, a little bit about Do the Right Thing. You've talked a lot about the use of color in it, and it jumps out from the very beginning, from Rosie Perez's opening dance sequence, you know, the red backgrounds mm-hmm. and the yellow, and the way you kind of use that to make it really feel like it's the hottest day of the summer. Can you talk a little bit just about how you think about color, both in that movie and kind of more generally? It seems to be one of your hallmarks.
You know, I've always been interested in color photography. When I was at Howard University, my major was architecture, but I took a minor in color photographic illustration. So it started with an interest in photography and really being interested more in color, really striking use of color. Some of the photographs of people like, definitely the color photography of Gordon Parks, Pete Turner, Jay Mizell, Ernst Haas, those were the photographers whose work I looked at. And when I got into cinematography, I started looking at people who really used color as a way of telling story. I think sometimes color is just taken for granted. We see it every day. It's all around us. But to control it and use it as a storytelling tool, I think, is of paramount importance. And so I was really struck one time when I was reading an article, I think it was in Playboy, it was an interview with John Huston, and they talked about the experiments with color, because he was one of the directors who also experimented with color, starting with Moulin Rouge. He did a version of Moulin Rouge in 1953, that started a relationship between him and the cinematographer Oswald Morris. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to really make the film look like one of Toulouse-Lautrec's paintings. And so they violated a lot of the rules that Technicolor had laid down, how they wanted their movies photographed. He filled the stage with smoke. They used fog filters on the cameras. And he used colored lights in the fill lights, colored gels on the fill lights. And so that started a relationship between John Huston and Oswald Morris that they continued through several films. And it was that and Moby Dick, the movie Moby Dick that he did, that had a very innovative use of color. And Huston, in the Playboy article, when he was questioned about this, they asked him, and he says he feels that every film should have its own palette. It should be part of the movie's own individual personality. And that made a lot of sense to me back then. And so that's something I've tried to incorporate in my work. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, when Spike and I were doing films like Do the Right Thing, the thing we wanted to do was immerse the audience into the experience. I remember Spike first gave me the challenge, you know, because we had completed school days. We were actually flying from New York to LA to look at the answer print for school days. And I was sitting next to Spike on the plane, and he bought, you know, took out his notebook. Because he would always write, and I think he still writes, and I write, on yellow legal pad, longhand on yellow legal pad. That's how he writes his scripts. Mm-hmm. And he was writing something at that time that was called Heat Wave, which was ultimately became Do the Right Thing. And he said, I want you to think about how we can really get the audience to feel the hottest day of the summer. What can we do to get the audience to feel the heat? And one of the first things... Two things I first thought about were exposure and use of color. Mm-hmm. And, you know, color has an effect on our lives that a lot of us are totally unaware of. The fact that different colors cause changes in your heart rate. That's why on submarines, the color schemes are usually more on the bluer or greens, you know, more cooler colors because they calm you down. Colors on the red side have a tendency to agitate you. They cause the heart to beat faster. And so in order to get the audience to feel the heat, I thought that, you know, limiting the color spectrum, the color scheme of the movie to reds, yellows, earth tones, and staying away from the cooler tones was the way to meet that challenge, to get the audience to feel the heat of the summer. And so, you know, that's something that I'm always looking for. I'm always looking for ways that I can use color in my films. How can I use the color to help tell the story? Just one more tool to help tell the story.
Yeah. With Juice, obviously, you know, the thing that sparked this conversation is the release of the 25th anniversary Blu-ray of
Juice.
Yes,
coming out tomorrow.
Coming out tomorrow.
Tomorrow, as of this taping, was Tuesday, June 6th, so it's already out.
Very, very excited about it. Had you written anything, any film before Juice?
In film school, and I wrote a couple of what actually got me into NYU graduate film was one of, you know, they want to see where your head is creatively, so they asked for something to show your creativity. So I had written a couple of scripts, you know, for short films, and I sent those in, but I had not written anything feature length. But, you know, Juice came out of the idea, okay, I'm graduating, so I'd like to do a film. And it was actually an idea that had been kicking around in my head for a while. You know, it came from several different places. One of them was, one of my dreams has always been to try and do a film adaptation of a book called Man Child in the Promised Land. It was written by Claude Brown. That when I was growing up in my first years in high school, that was like required reading for any young black man. And it's, you know, a lot of it is Claude Brown's growing up in Harlem in the late 40s and the early 50s into the 60s. So his adventures growing up, you know, recalled my adventures, you know, growing up in the projects in Newark, you know, how I kind of like always related to that. And so that was part of it, you know, wanting to do Man Child of the Promised Land, but knowing I couldn't get the rights to it, but still interested in, you know, the lives of young black men on a day-by-day level. And then, you know, when I was my first year at Howard, after my first year, I had a summer job working in the post office. Hardest job I've ever had in my life. Ugh. but working at a post office for the summer. And, you know, you had to check in by 6:59 a.m. So I'm always on the bus before the sun comes up, taking the bus to work before the sun comes up. And sometimes I would see these young kids on the bus, these young guys who are probably around 10 or 11 years old, who looked like they had been out all night long hanging out. And I was like, wondering, what were they doing? What kind of stuff were they getting into? And I thought, you know, there's a thriller idea around that. So that was also the germ of the idea. Plus, Gerard Brown, who co-wrote the script with me, and I, we were being continuously horrified by how prevalent guns were becoming available to young kids, young guys in the neighborhoods, you know, when it wasn't like that when we were growing up, you know, like that you could get into a beef with somebody and all of a sudden guns could come out and you start shooting at each other. But when we were growing up, you got into a beef with somebody, you know, you took care of it with your fists. And it's like those days were gone forever. But where this was coming from was really horrifying. So those were the things that started it. And you know, I wanted to do a film noir.
Right.
The idea was to do a film noir where the leads were 16 and 17 years old. And so we started working on the script. And some of the characters came out of interviews that I did with my brother-in-law and some of his friends. My brother-in-law at the time, Eddie, was living on 132nd Street. No, I'm sorry. Yeah, 132nd Street in Riverside Drive. And so he, you know, in that area, he and his boys, you know, I just spent hours with them taping recordings, you know, taping conversations that we had, talking about, you know, their day-to-day lives, what they've been going through, stuff they had seen, you know, things that had happened to them, attitudes in the neighborhoods, things like that. And so from that, that's where the screenplay came from.
Wow. Were there any particular film noirs that you used as a model, either in structure or look or tone?
I think way in the back of my head, there was a movie I had seen years earlier called The City Across the River. And I remember it being noteworthy because I think it was Tony Curtis's first film. And it was about these young gang members who get into trouble.
I wished I could afford that.
Oh, yeah. Some car.
Not the car, the dame.
I told you the guy was crazy.
We're going to take care of a guy. Benny, can you get your brother's car?
Sure. Oh, boy, action. Wait till they see me. I'll meet you.
I better not go. It's kind of late and tomorrow's school.
He's yelling. Frankie's yelling.
You shut up. Listen to me, Frankie. I've been watching you. You think you're too good for the Dukes or something? We don't like guys with water in their blood.
What's the matter, Larry?
You know, they're just like young kids who get into trouble. So I remember that. But other than that, no, it pretty much came from, you know, the stories that we heard and the stuff that Gerard and I put together.
I read that some of the initial money people who wanted to do it wanted to make it a comedy. How on earth could that story have been made into a comedy? Like, what were they thinking?
Well, what was crazy was that we wrote Juice. We shot Juice in 91, but we wrote it in around 81, 82. And when I finally got an agent, you know, I gave it to my agent. And basically he said, nobody wants to see this film. No, you'll never get this made. Ernest, it's a good script. Forget about it. It's too dark. It's just, you're not going to get it made. And so I forgot about it. You know, I mean, it basically sat on the shelf for like the next 8-9 years. And, you know, showed it to different people, but they always said, it's too grim. It's too dark. Nobody wants to see this, you know, forget about it. And, you know, my career as a cinematographer was taken off. And so I was cool. Gerard, who wrote the script with me, he was playwright in residence at Joe Papp's Public Theater. And he was, a playwright whose plays were being put on there. So, you know, there was no skin off his teeth. So we both forgot about it until Gerard went and got a new agent. He was shopping for a new agent. And the one who he got, who looked like wanted to take him on, said, well, you know, I want to see some work that you've written. You know, I want to see some screenplays. And so he took Juice out and dusted it off and gave it to her. And she said, well, what's up with this? Why? What are you doing with this? And Gerard said, nothing. Nobody, we got no encouragement. We were told by everybody that read the script that nobody wants to see this movie. And so she said, can I try to sell it? And he said, yeah. So he called me up and said, is it okay with you? I said, yeah, sure. You know, but, you know, you know, what happened the first time around. So she takes it around, and all of a sudden there's several production companies that want to buy it. And when Gerard and I first wrote it, we wanted to premiere ourselves. We wanted to use it as a way of premiering ourselves as a writer-director team. Mm-hmm. And so it goes out, you know, it was always something I was going to direct. So she took it out, and all of a sudden these companies wanted to do it. And they sent us back lists of who they thought should direct it. And the lists were usually like 2 to 3 pages, and my name was the very last one at the bottom. And so we were like, okay, well, that's the way Hollywood works. And then we started getting notes. Jesus. Yeah. Yeah. Like notes that, okay, we love this script, but we think it's a little bit too dark. It might work better as a coming of age comedy. You know, maybe you need to rewrite it and make it funnier, more one liners and, you know, a real comedy. And we hated what the notes were saying, you know, because it was that old story of a script that starts out as a real promising piece of work, but gets developed into a piece of shit. And so Gerard and I basically looked at each other and we said, you know, forget this, man. We, you know, don't like what they have to say about this. So we basically took the script back. You know, we could have made money on it, but we took the script back. And life goes on. And then I got a phone call one day. A British gentleman on the other end of the line said he'd read the script and he wanted to talk to me about it. And so his name was David Heyman. We met at a place called the Pink Teacup in the Village, which was a soul food restaurant. We met for brunch and we talked, and he asked me, you know, how I saw the film. And I told him that it's got to be a real gritty, real on the streets film, real and raw. I said, there's no actors who we know of who can play these roles. So we got to go for unknowns. And after talking for a couple of hours, he said, I like what you had to say. Do you want me to get funding for it? I said, yeah.
should have just said that in the first place. Yeah, right.
You know, yeah. And that's how it started. He got the funding from Island Pictures, which was an offshoot of Island Records, of which his father was a co-owner of with Chris Blackwell. So that's what happened. What had happened was that a friend of David's, a guy named Peter Frankfurt, who had been working at one of the production companies the one that wanted to buy it and gave us the notes. When we took it back, you know, he got a copy of the script and sent it to David. He and David and Neil Moritz were looking for something to debut themselves as producers on, and it turned out to be Juice.
Yeah, and he did okay as a producer in the years to come.
Yeah, he did. he really did. David did
something about a wizard, a little kid going to school of a wizard. He produced, yeah.
And then a lady astronaut who gets stuck in orbit around the Earth.
As you may have already guessed, David Heyman was the producer on all of the Harry Potter films, as well as the 2013 Oscar-winning hit, Gravity.
He did okay for himself.
He did good.
Yeah. So what kind of changes did you have to make between you write it in 1981 and then it gets dusted off and you start filming? How much did you have to change? Just cultural references and slang, or did you have to rework more than that?
Most of it was dialogue. It was slang. It was that. The role that eventually went to Queen Latifah was originally written for Afrika Bambaataa. By that time, he didn't want to have anything to do with our film.
Can I ask why? Do you remember why? Or did he say why?
I don't remember why. I remember a lot of... There were quite a few gangster rappers who at that time weren't crazy about the script. You know, I guess they didn't think our film was hard enough. But, you know, there were a lot of different reasons. But we wound up going to Latifah, and I met Latifah recently on Jungle Fever. Mm-hmm. So she came in and did it.
Wait, I know you didn't just snap that.
It's my attempt.
I know you
What's
didn't
wrong
snap
with my mix?
Look, the shit is totally sloppy. Only a fool would open up the way you do. Nobody likes the records that you play, all right? It's just completely whack. Face it.
Fuck you!
Well, you might have a chance if that shit wasn't so small.
So it was, but the changes we had to make over those years was mostly dialogue. And even in the shooting, that changed. Because, you know, by that time, I was 40 years old. So, you know.
No longer a finger on the pulse of youth culture, I'd imagine.
I tried to, but you try to stay current. But when you're working and raising a family, you know, it's hard to do that. So,
right.
But the basic action and the basic story stayed the same.
How did you talk to Puck about his character? You know, you've told the audition how he got the role. Like, you've told that plenty of times.
And Tretch comes in. He's got his friend with him. And we, you know, and asked his friend, okay, just kind of like sit in the back, you know, and whatnot. And Tretch read, and, you know, I think he was reading for the role of Q, did a pretty good job. We said, okay, thanks a lot. And going out, we looked at his friend and said, what about you? He says, me? He said, yeah. I said, well, you want to read? I said, yeah, sure, why not? What's your name? Tupac. After the audition, I said, oh, very nice. Okay, very good. Thank you very much. Do we have a way of getting in contact with you? He said, yeah. I said, okay, thanks. He walks out the door. Please close the door. Close the door. We said, phew.
Once he was in, how did you talk about his character, about Bishop, to him?
You know, there's an old saying that 90% of directing is casting. And that is so true. Because casting, when it's done right, can be the most exhausting, nerve-wracking experience in the world, because you're trying to find somebody that knows who that character is, who can go in and become that person, know that person by, you know, in to the depths of their heart, and become that person. And so Tupac knew Bishop. The reason he got the role was because he understood the pain in the character, the pain deep down inside Bishop that made him question his place in the world, his place in his neighborhood.
Right. He actually says at one point that basically everything he's doing comes out of self-hate. That comes out of his mouth at one point.
I don't give a fuck about you. I don't give a fuck about Steel. And I don't give a fuck about Raheem either. I don't give a fuck about myself. Like, I ain't shit. I ain't never gonna be shit. And you less of a man than me. So as soon as I decide that you ain't gonna be shit,
and that was why he got the role, was because he understood that about the character. Mm-hmm. That's what's great about finding somebody like that. And that's why casting is such an important part, because when you find the right actor, me as a director, all I got to do is basically, you know, sit back and watch and become the first audience for the film and maybe give suggestions here and there, a nudge here or a little, you know, push in this direction, or, well, he did this. That's great. So let's try a little bit of this. But the basic spine and the basic, all the guts of the performance are already there, because that actor knows who that character is and is becoming that character. And so that's what you're always looking for. You're looking for the verisimilitude that that person's going to bring to it. And that's what he did. So when you have that, it's all a question of, you know, blocking and staging. You know, sometimes you say, okay, let's do it again, but just bring it down a little bit. You know, a little adjustments to the performance. Mm-hmm. And that's all I had to do with all the guys, because I, you know, pat myself on the back, but I think I cast the film really well.
Yeah. Did they hang out a lot, the crew, the four of them, during the time of filming? Because they have the banter is so realistic seeming, and they,
yeah,
it seems like they have this lived in history.
Yeah, they did. That's one of the reasons why those four wound up being the guys, because, you know, when I had narrowed the casting down to about 12 people, I did mixing and matching, because I wanted to find the four guys who together would create a fifth person, which was the group, the crew, being, you know, the group mind. And when you look at the extras on the upcoming Blu-ray, there's an interview with the four guys, and you can see how tight they were. You can see how they just like bounced off each other, how they hung out. And they definitely hung out together. You know, when we were putting the Blu-ray together, and we found this interview with the four guys, it was amazing, because I had not seen that. I vaguely remembered them doing it, because I do pop into it at one point. Mm-hmm. But it's like gold, man. It's like, you know, seeing the four guys together and how they interact with each other, which is like totally off the cuff, is so much fun. So that's one of the things we're proudest of in the upcoming Blu-ray release, the Blu-ray DVD release.
Yeah.
And that there's a lot of stuff behind the scenes that nobody's ever seen before.
I can't wait to see it. What was it like directing your mother?
it was pretty cool. It was pretty cool. She really worked on getting that, you know, using the heel of her hand to push the clip into the gun. tell your mom Jackie says hi.
Are you Lorraine Powell's son?
Yes.
Tell your mother Jackie said hi. Yeah.
My mother had worked for many years at the Newark Public Library, mm-hmm. and she had just retired, and she was, you know, very active woman. She retired. She said, okay, now what am I going to do with my time? And so she was trying to find something to do with her time. And when we were shooting Jungle Fever, she came She was actually an extra in Jungle Fever. If you look at Jungle Fever, there's a scene between Wesley and Lynette McKee where they're in Bloomingdale's and they're arguing. And there's this little lady in the background, you know, who's shopping, who's standing there listening to them.
These are for you.
I don't want them. Where's you
never failed? I need to talk.
I don't want to talk to you.
Please. And that's my mom. And so it was her first time actually spending time on a set, on a film set.
Wow. And then she graduated to a speaking role in Juice.
You know, she was there and she said, you know, I like this. She said, maybe I can do this. She said, how can I get this? I said, well, mom, you gotta get into SAG. You gotta get into the Screen Actors Guild. And so she said, so how do I get into the Screen Actors Guild? I said, well, you gotta have a film role. Well, how am I gonna get a film role? I don't know, mom. Let me figure it out.
Right.
So I'm planning Juice and I said, okay, well, this might be a way of my mom getting a SAG card so that she could, you know, work in her retirement, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I figured, okay, maybe my mom can be a school teacher. Maybe even though we kind of religiously tried to keep parents in our screenplay to the minimum because just wanted to differentiate between the two worlds at home and then out in the street. I said, well, maybe I can put a teacher thing in there when Q comes back and I can have the teacher say something to him in the hallway. And maybe that could be my mom. But you know, sometimes your best ideas come to you when you're taking a shower in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And the character of Sweets was written for a guy. And I think I dropped the soap in the shower and I'm reaching for the soap and bing, it hit me. Why not my mom play Sweets? I said, it's a crazy idea, but yeah. You know, my mother grew up in Boston, Massachusetts, Roxbury. She knew Malcolm X when he was in his Zoot Suit phase. She lived right around the corner from Malcolm Little, who became Malcolm X. So she knew, you know, people, she knew gangsters. You know, later on, I found out that a lot of my mother's associates and friends of the family were numbers runners and gangsters.
Mm.
So my mom knows OGs. So I said, she can be an OG. So I said, okay, let's make Sweets my mom. And so we did. And it was interesting because there was an extra there and she and the young lady extra became good friends. And so I said, okay, maybe you two ladies are sitting together. So maybe there's a bit of a gay subtext there, you know? But she did it. And then I created a monster because every film I got from then on, it was like, well, what's my role? You know? And she would always say, now, Ernest, remember, you got to give me a part. Now, Marty Scorsese always has his mother and his father in his movies. And I said, yeah, mom, you're right. So she's in Surviving the Game.
Oh, wow.
When the dog gets hit in the beginning and the lady that jumps out of the taxi cab.
That's her.
Yelling and screaming. Yeah.
Look at her, please.
Take my money. What about my money?
Take my money. It's $60.
That's my mom. So for a while, every film that I did, I had to have her in it.
Yeah. Juice was a film noir, basically, but I don't know how many people picked up on that at the time. But you go from these critically well-regarded Spike Lee films, right? And directing Juice, which gets a lot of critical love, to genre movies, so horror movies, which a lot of people, even, you know, within and without of the movie business, kind of look down on. I was wondering if you could talk about making that transition a little bit.
Well, I mean, I consider myself a genre filmmaker. Genre is just an interesting way to platform ideas, I think. I grew up on genre movies. You know, the movies that I saw when I was a kid, you know, Jason and the Argonauts, The Great Escape, The Vikings, you know, Day of the Triffids, Kung Fu films. Used to see a lot of Kung Fu films. The James Bond movies were big for me when I was a kid. So horror films was something. The first film that I remember seeing in life was a monster movie called It Came From Beneath the Sea, about a giant octopus that destroyed the Golden Gate Bridge.
The H-bomb blasted it loose from the depths of the Pacific. But not even the H-bomb can kill it.
Unknown object coming this way. Entering minefield. Stand by, number 38, mine. Fire.
West Coast reels under Holocaust as the men and weapons of the atomic age battle to the death against the ageless monster of the deep.
I saw that in Boston. It must have been, the movie came out in 55.
You were about four,
About 4 years old, and I remember vividly seeing that movie. I remember it being a rainy day, but I remember being totally struck by that movie and the movie that was playing with it, which was called A Creature with the Atom Brain.
Fission Science creates an electronic monster so terrifying, only screams can describe it.
Which is so amazing because these are things that I put together years later.
Mm-hmm.
And then one day, after I met Joe Dante in the Masters of Horror dinners.
Now all in one place. 13 original one-hour movies from the Masters of Horror.
It's happening. You see so many bad things in your life.
Masters of Horror was an anthology television series on Showtime that grew out of dinners thrown by director Mick Garris. Some of the people at the dinners were John Carpenter, John Landis, Guillermo del Toro, David Cronenberg, Quentin Tarantino, Dario Argento, Toby Hooper, and Eli Roth. Joe Dante, also a regular at the dinners, directed many films including Piranha, The Howling, The Burbs, Gremlins 2, The New Batch, and Looney Tunes Back in Action. Ernest directed one episode in the two-season run of Masters of Horror, The V-Word, about a couple of teenagers who make a mistake and break into a mortuary and wind up running into a vampire played by Michael Ironside. After two seasons, Showtime didn't renew the series, but NBC picked it up as a series called Fear Itself, and 13 episodes were shot. Unfortunately, that show was canceled before Ernest's episode, Something with Bite, could air. Wendell Pierce, who Ernest worked with on Malcolm X, The Wire, and would later work with on Tremé, starred in the episode, which you can find on DVD and some streaming services. When we reached out to Pierce for memories of working with Ernest, he said, quote, "Ernest Dickerson has an encyclopedic knowledge of cinema. As an actor, he gives you freedom but knows exactly when to interject. Brilliant."
What is that ungodly ruckus?
Kate's driving down the road and it just jumped out in front of me.
Oh, my gosh. There you are. Okay, I know it's you. Okay.
What the hell is it?
I got it.
Well, stay back, Michaela.
We're going to need a bigger gurney.
And I was telling the first movie I remember seeing was It Came From Beneath the Sea. He says, yes, that was in a double bill with Creature with the Atom Brain. So, see, he knew that. And I said, yes, that's true. So my cousin always used to take me to see horror films. I don't know. Growing up in the projects in Newark, New Jersey, horror and science fiction films were a big thing for us. Mm. I mean, you know. Going to see the Tingler. I remember going to see the Tingler in the movie theater. I remember going to see...
Was the Tingler one of those that had the special things in the seats?
For the first time in motion picture history, members of the audience, including you, will actually play a part in the picture. You will feel some of the physical reactions, the shocking sensations experienced by the actors on the screen.
Yeah, but you know, I went to see it at a theater in New Jersey. We didn't have the Tingler in the seats, but... You know, there's a part in the movie where the Tingler gets loose in the movie theater, in the actual movie, and then the screen goes black. And you hear Vincent Price saying, "Ladies and gentlemen, the Tingler is loose in the movie theater. If you want to live, scream, scream for your life.
Please do not panic, but scream, scream for your lives. The Tingler is loose in this theater, and if you don't scream, it may kill you. Scream, scream. Keep screaming. Scream for your life! It's here! It's over here! Help! Help!
Help! Look out, it's under the seat!
Ladies and gentlemen,
it's under the seat!
The Tingler has been paralyzed by your screaming. There is no more danger. We will now resume the showing of the movie.
And when that happened in the theater that I was in, the screen goes black, the movie stops, the ushers kind of come in, the ushers in the theater come in, they walked down to the front of the theater, and one of the ushers, had, unknown to all of us, had planted himself on the floor, laying down like he had been attacked. And the ushers pick him up and carry him out, you know. And then they start the movie again. And I'm looking at this, and I must have been about 7 years old by this time. And I'm like, oh, shit. Although I didn't say that, but sure. I probably said, oh shoot. But that was a big thing back in those days. And I remember vividly the fact that the movie was in black and white, but when the blood started coming out of the taps, it was red. You know, that kind of stuff struck me. So, you know, horror films are something I always grew up on. It was always a big thing, you know.
Yeah.
Horror films and science fiction films. So, you know, I was always attracted to genres. I became a fan of Alfred Hitchcock when I was in high school. I remember seeing Vertigo for the first time on Saturday Night at the Movies on Channel 4, NBC Channel 4. And it just struck me. It was a movie that stayed with me. And it's one of my favorite films to this day. So I've always loved horror films, and I've always read science fiction. I still read science fiction. Growing up, I always used to read science fiction novels, adventure novels. I used to read a lot of Edgar Rice Burroughs, not only the Tarzan books, but the John Carter of Mars stuff and the Carson of Venus. All those science fiction books, and H.G. Wells and Jules Verne. All that stuff I used to read when I was a kid, and loved seeing the movies when they came out, if they were good movies. Loved Ray Harryhausen films, you know.
Mm-hmm. You pay tribute to him in some stuff in Demon Knight.
Demon Knight's special effects artist Todd Masters revealed in an interview that one of the film's most ambitious scenes, where the villain played by Billy Zane summons forth his demonic minions, was intended as a tribute to Harryhausen, who of course did the animation on films like The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, Jason and the Argonauts, and Clash of the Titans.
Yeah, Seventh Voyage of Sinbad was a big movie for me when I was about 7 years old, I think. That and Jason and the Argonauts and Mysterious Island, First Men in the Moon, all those stuff, you know, those were big events for us when we were kids.
Yeah.
And so I have a love for that genre, and especially when it's done right. So when Demon Knight came my way, I thought it was a chance to do something interesting. I thought it was a chance to create a mythology, a new mythology.
Did you hear of Jada Pinkett through her high school classmate, Tupac? Is that how you came across her?
No. What hipped me to Jada was seeing the film, the movie that showcased Lorenz Tate that came out around that time, that Jada was in.
Ernest is thinking of the 1993 film Menace to Society.
What had happened was that I went in and met on Demon Knight. I read it, you know, read the script. They sent me the script. I met on it. And I actually, when I met on that, I was going through the final sound mix of Surviving the Game. And so I brought the producers into the sound mix so they could see Surviving the Game and make the ultimate decision if they wanted to hire me or not. And they did. And, you know, the character of Geraldine, I always saw her as this little feisty lady. And then when I saw the Hughes Brothers film, Jada's in it, and I thought she was great.
Yeah.
I was hoping that maybe you would come with me.
Came with you?
Yeah, I mean, you ain't doing jack shit here, and the way that I see it, you'll be dead or you'll be in jail.
I mean, I don't know, I don't see it as such a bad idea.
Why are you so worried about me?
Shouldn't
that be? And so I tried to sell her to Joel Silver. And, you know, Joel had his idea of who else he wanted, you know, but I said, I think Jade would be ideal for this. And for me, it was a chance to do something that hadn't been done before. I thought it was a chance to put a young African-American lady in a position where you think she's going to die. You know, she's one of those characters that, you know, she's going to die. She's not going to make it to the end of the movie, but then she does. And she winds up becoming the next Demon Knight. And I think Joel wanted Cameron Diaz for that role, but you know, I just kept pushing Jada, And then he finally met Jada and he was impressed with her, and she got the role. So I was happy to do the first film where an African-American lady saves the world. So, you know, it was a chance to develop a new mythology around the key, and, you know, the promise of further adventures, because it definitely has that open ending.
Right. You're right in that. I mean, there may be other movies. People can certainly correct me if I'm wrong, but yeah, maybe the first horror film with a black woman as heroine.
Yeah. And, you know, set her up as just, you know, kind of like a background person, background figure who mm-hmm. you just figure, okay, she's black. She's going to be one of the first persons to go. That's Geraldine. Usually what happens.
Geraldine, I mean now.
Look, Irene, I am trying to clean your stove. All right, now, how do you expect me to get my work done if you keep bothering me?
You've been working so hard with them clean rubber gloves? Show Mr. Smith up to number 5.
And then just completely overturned that expectation. Yeah. So, you know, it worked out pretty good, because even CCH Pounder stays until almost the very end.
Almost the end, yeah. Yeah, her character is great too, as sort of the owner of this hotel, hostel, whatever, you know, boarding house.
Yeah,
whatever.
Yeah,
it is.
It was a lot of fun making that film. It was tough. It's all set at night, and I told the producers early on. I said, you know, I think it's going to be counterproductive to actually try and shoot this in a desert setting at night. I think, you know, 40 nights is going to be murder
in the desert. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's going to be murder on the crew.
Right.
So I said, can we do this on a stage someplace? And so they actually were able to get a decommissioned airplane hangar at Van Nuys Airport. And that's where we built the house. The same production designer, Christian Wagner, who had done Surviving the Game for me, I brought him on to do Demon Night. And so he designed the house for the exterior to be seen from one direction. And then all the filming inside the house was, you know, it was all there. But it allowed us to have regular daylight hours, you know, shoot nights, but, you know, shoot day for nights inside. And it really made the work a lot. It went faster. We were able to get a lot more done. And I think it just kept the crew in a better mood to keep them going.
Than being in a freezing desert or scorching hot desert, depending on time of day for
exactly
a month and a
exactly.
half. Yeah.
And not have to worry about the sun coming up or if it decided to rain or something, you know,
right.
Not have to worry about those. It was an ideal situation. So, and it gave me total control, which was really important because I didn't have a long shooting schedule on that film, not by most film standards. So I had to make the most of every single moment of shooting. So
yeah. Bones, which you directed, was that written for Snoop Dogg?
Yeah. Snoop was already attached when I came aboard.
Mm-hmm.
It was cool. It was really cool. It was interesting because, you know, sometimes working with musicians can be, you know, can be challenging.
You've done more than your share of it, I think, over the years.
Yeah, shooting. Yeah, it can be challenging. You know, because the work requirement, the work ethic is totally different. But Snoop was there all the time, and actually, a friend of mine had AD'd a couple of music videos with Snoop. And he said, man, one person you'll never have to worry about is Snoop. Snoop is there. He'll be there on time. And he's always prepared, which was totally true. He was a joy to work with. He was always knew what he was doing. I mean, he was high all the time. No doubt about that. You know,
sure.
You know, because he was blunted, but knew what he was doing, knew his lines, knew the character. But I got to tell you, one of the highlights of my life was seeing Snoop blush after he had kissed Pam Grier.
Pam Grier, Snoop's co-star in Bones, is an actress best known for her string of starring roles in a series of blaxploitation films in the 70s. Among the best known of these were Foxy Brown, Coffee, and Scream, Blackula, Scream. And nobody blames Snoop for blushing.
After the first time he kissed Pam Grier, and they're into the clinch, and they're mm-hmm. kissing, and then I said, cut. And it was like, Snoop just kind of like went into like this little boy thing.
Right.
You know, and he was blushing. And I said, Snoop, you blushing? He said, don't you expect me to blush? Come on, man. I grew up dreaming about this lady and I get to kiss her. You know, so it was amazing. You know, Snoop did he was there, man. He did a great job. There was just one day where I asked him not to smoke. You know, to wait until we got this one shot, which was him walking up a burning staircase, because he was going to be walking very close to some flame bars.
Mm.
And I just wanted to, you know, just keep, you know, make paramount. Safety is paramount on all of my sets. So I just wanted to make sure that he was going to be OK. So I said, you know, just do me a favor. Don't smoke until after we get that shot done, you know, because it's really important. I can't take any risks. But it was great. It was shooting in Vancouver. We shot in Vancouver. It was winter into spring. So, you know, we had some of that famous Vancouver rainy weather,
right,
which helped contribute to some of the look of the film.
Yeah. There's a lot going on in that film, actually. Idea-wise, it's about intra-racial class tensions. It's about the drug trade. There's a lot of stuff going on in that. And it is, minus, I think, the one corrupt cop, an entirely black world in the film. Can you talk a bit about kind of creating the world of Bones and some of the ideas in it?
Yeah, it was a great design process because I'm a fan of a lot of Italian horror films, and so I wanted to try and put some of that aesthetic into that. And so again, use of color, you know, where to introduce certain colors, where to introduce reds, and also the color schemes of the different time periods, because when we first meet Jimmy Bones, it's the 70s, and, you know, it's a more colorful time.
Totally widescreen, sci-fi, forward-thinking, and I can dig that. But that's for you and yours. Me and Mars, we cool as a motherfucking icicle in the freezer. Oh, yeah, by the way, your 12 and a half minutes is up. Hey, sorry about that, Jay Byrne.
And actually, the weather worked beautifully with us because it had been dreary and cloudy, but the day we had to shoot the 70s stuff, we had bright, sunny day. It was like the first day of spring. And so the colors that we put out there did pop. So the weather gods were with us at that moment. I had a really good production designer, Douglas Higgins, who was Canadian. And we worked out designing the whole world, the world inside Jimmy Bones' house. And so that house was built to be shot. The exterior was on location in Vancouver, in this one block that's supposed to be like the roughest neighborhood in Vancouver. There was a big vacant lot there. And I wanted Jimmy Bones' house to be standing by itself as if the whole neighborhood had been knocked down, but only Bones' house was there. And working with Doug, we were able to design the facade of the house so it does kind of look like a face. It, you know, we always wanted to suggest that even though Jimmy Bones had died, we found out later on that he was murdered, that he's still there, that he's always there, that his spirit is inhabiting that block. So the design process, you know, took us into that and, you know, just really tried to make a really good horror script, but also, you know, something that means something, because when you lose the person you love, especially somebody that you've been lovers with, somebody that you know intimately, you know, everybody that has happened to, they always wish there was some way to bring that person back. And that's something that I wanted to really incorporate into Pam's character. She lost Jimmy Bones, and her dream that she probably dare not utter to anybody is that she would love to have him come back. But then when he does come back, it's not at all what she was expecting.
Right.
So, I mean, you know, earlier in my life, you know, I lost somebody that I was in love with, who was taken suddenly away. And, you know, you always go back and think about that and wonder what would happen if that person came back. So I wanted to put that experience into the film, into her character's experience. So, and Pam was great to work with. She's an amazing lady. Really, really cool. Totally open.
And for the flashback stuff, she got to dress like Foxy Brown again.
Yeah, I mean, well, the fact is, you know, she really didn't look like she had aged much.
Yeah.
You know, so it was so easy for her to do the two time periods.
Yeah.
And I had recently met Pam on a potential other project that didn't work out. And so when I got on Bone, Snoop was the only person who was attached to it. And I said, well, let's try and get Pam Grier because I think she could.
Oh, he must have loved that.
Oh, he did. He did. I mean, I'm telling you, every time he kissed her, he blushed, you know, and that's not something you see Snoop do often.
Yeah, I'm sure. So we're coming up to change topics just a little bit. We're coming up on the 15th anniversary of The Wire, I believe just passed, you know, so people are sort of thinking and talking about it again. Obviously, you directed some of the most iconic episodes of the series.
When you walk through the garden.
Ernest directed 6 episodes of The Wire, Bad Dreams in Season 2, Hamsterdam and Mission Accomplished in Season 3, Misgivings and Final Grades in Season 4, and Unconfirmed Reports in Season 5.
One thing I was curious about, The Wire had this interesting combination of seasoned actors and of non-actors and of people who were in entertainment in other ways, musicians like Method Man, stuff like that. What kind of challenges did having that mix of performers present for you as a director?
Still, it's the same thing. It's, does that person who's playing that role understand that character? Do they know that character? Can they become that character? And I think that's what the producers understood when they hired people like Method Man, who had no previous acting experience. You know, I'm sure Method was one of several people that they talked to, that they auditioned, but he must have done something in his auditions to show that he knew who that person was. He knew who that character was. He knew how to take that from inside himself and put it outside and show it to the camera. And that was the same with everybody, you know, pretty much everybody on there who had a major part, even some of the smaller roles. Like I did the Hamsterdam episode. One of the young brothers that, you know, who coined the phrase Hamsterdam, you know, he was, you know, young Baltimore kid.
This here the spot, because Tucky says he's supposed to set up shop here. Hamsterdam.
Yeah, this is it. Set up anywhere inside where we got the white flags.
And they bought him on, and he could just say a line or two in a very convincing way. But people like Method Man, and then in the fourth season with the kids, those were all young men who must have shown something in the casting. But the person that worked with him on a daily basis was Robert Chu, who played Proposition Joe in the film, the late, great Robert Chu. He was their acting coach. He told them they had daily classes and how to break down a script, how to go through it, and how to turn that into a performance. And that's why, as that season goes on, the kids were pretty good at first, but they got better as it got along because they had, you know, the training, the experience that they were getting on a day-by-day basis was just increasing their acting chops.
Snitch, bitch.
Yo, what the fuck was that? I don't know.
Do you have an appointment?
Why need an appointment?
Zenobia, I don't think she needs an appointment.
Sorry, just trying to make it realistic.
So I get to see somebody?
You going to take a number and wait.
I need to see somebody right now.
Don't get angry. Anger doesn't...
Elton Brand, what you know about him? Nothing. See? Quiet.
Bug, you seen your daddy?
Went to the store.
Where you going?
I'm gonna go look for him.
You ain't gonna find him.
Why not?
Because he ain't coming back.
But it starts with somebody, finding somebody that understands who that character is. And then sometimes, you know, you got to say, okay, you know who that person is. So put yourself in that person and be yourself, but be yourself coming out of that person, out of that character. I think it's little things like that. But it starts with that knowledge. You know, if you have to explain a character to an actor or an actress, chances are they're not going to do a good job with it.
Right.
Because if their understanding of that character is not there, then you're going to have a hard time of it.
While you're doing it, presumably, mostly you're thinking about, let's finish the episode in 8 days, and are we going to get renewed, and are they going to call me again? You don't necessarily think this is a classic or whatever. At what point did you realize, hey, this is television sort of for the ages, this is a great series?
I came in at the end of the second season. I think by the third season, when I started seeing who was watching the show, Because you know, it was virtually unknown for years. I mean, a lot of people are still just discovering or still haven't discovered The Wire. You know, one of the great things about, you know, directing a show like that is if you come in to do a later episode, then you got to watch all the previous episodes. So I've already had a chance to binge watch most of the season because I came in and did a couple of season finales. I did the third season finale and the fourth season finale. And I had done other episodes earlier, but what's great about that, when you come in to do a later episode, then you get to see the whole show. You get to see the whole season almost all the way through. Everything that's been, all the cuts that have been done, everything that's been cut and ready to go out, you get a chance to see all that.
Right. And this was years before, obviously, before binge watching was standard practice.
Yeah. And so, you know, you get a chance to do that. I remember my daughter was in college. My oldest daughter was in college, and she was in college in Philadelphia. And she came down and spent a long weekend with me one time. And I think it was when I was doing the third or the fourth season. And I had to watch all these episodes, and she watched them with me. She binged watched them all with me. And it was like, okay, we're just going to watch three, then we're going to go do something else. Okay. All right. And after the third episode, well, let's look at maybe two more, you know, and then we'll look at two more. Well, maybe let's look at another one, you know. And we wound up watching the whole season in one day. And, you know, just when you were able to see that, see it all together, then you realize, wow, this is really, really something. And the fact that, you know, The Wire was the first show to come on that had that serialized aspect to it, where it's all basically one story for the whole season, as opposed to the average television show at that time was the entire story is told in one episode. But the serialized version was kind of taken from British television, which up till that time was the best television ever made. So, you know, the fact that it was an innovation in television storytelling was, you know, it was a lot of fun. And it was challenging because that was one of the problems that the show had earlier on. The management at HBO, they were a little bit upset that it wasn't like an average show where you could tune in at any time and know what was going on.
Right.
You had to commit to the show. You had to watch it from the beginning. It was like reading a book. And as a filmmaker, you know, for me, it was great because they wanted a filmmaker's sensibilities for it. So I missed The Wire. It was great shooting in Baltimore.
Yeah. So most recently, you directed something by a good friend of the show, Lisa Cortez. She produced it called Double Play. So What is Double Play? When can we expect to see it outside of festivals?
It just got released in Europe, first limited release in Europe. It'll probably go through Europe for a little bit before we're able to come to the States. It's a story that's set on the island of Curaçao, which is a Caribbean island right off the coast of Venezuela.
And when you have a long personal history with, right? You've been there, going there since the 80s.
Yeah. Actually, that year that I did She's Gotta Have It, that was a productive year for me as a cinematographer because I started out doing the second season of Tales from the Dark Side. And then I got on Crush Groove. And then we did She's Gotta Have It in 2 weeks. And then I went to Curaçao to do Almacita de Desolato, which had me on the island of Curaçao for 3 months shooting that film for a friend of mine, Felix DeRoy, who was a filmmaker who I met at NYU film school. And so I shot two films for Felix and his partner on Curaçao, Almacita de Desolato in 1985, and then Ava and Gabrielle in 1989. And Felix is a very well-known artist in the Caribbean. He's considered the Caribbean Cocteau, Jean Cocteau of the Caribbean. And so he's a filmmaker, play director, sculptor, painter, a really great artist. And that's why I brought him on to be my production designer on Double Play. But Double Play is based on a novel by a Curaçaoan writer named Frank Martinez Arion. And he's like one of their leading literary lights, or was. He passed away 2 days before we went down to start pre-production. But the book that he wrote called Double Play came out in 1974. And it's a tale of post-colonial politics, sexual politics, marriage, love, betrayal, adultery, murder and suicide that all comes to a head during a game of dominoes between four friends on a hot summer Sunday in 1973. It's a book that is practically unknown in the United States. It was part of a projected series of Caribbean classic novels that an American publisher was going to do, but that series was short-lived. And by the time they discontinued it, there had only been a couple of hundred copies of Double Play translated into English. So when I first got the project, I tried to find a copy of Double Play online. And on Amazon, a paperback copy was costing $285. That's how rare it was. So but it was amazing how it came to me, because I had just taken my wife there the previous Christmas and New Year's. We were there for like 10 days during holiday and really just having a great time, and I had my camera and I'm taking a lot of photographs. And the color on the island is absolutely amazing because the architecture in Curaçao is painted the most fabulous colors, you know, the pinks, oranges, reds, yellows, you know, because in the 1700s, a law was passed that buildings could not be painted white because the glare from the sun was hurting people's eyes. And so as a result, people started painting their houses in different colors, and they would go crazy with it. You know, you would have like really, really amazing color. So I'm taking all these photographs, and I said to my wife, I said, you know, I would love to do another movie here. But that's never going to happen. How's that ever going to happen? I can't imagine how that's ever going to happen. And then about 3 months later, the script came to me. My manager called me up. Said, you know, she called me up. She said, you've been to Curaçao a couple of times, haven't you? I said, yeah, a bunch of times. She said, well, I have a script to set on the island of Curaçao. And I read it and kind of like knew immediately what the film should be because I had spent so much time on the island. And so I called Lisa, and it was our first time on the phone. We talked for a couple of hours and told her that I had been to the island a bunch of times, that I had resources on the island, knew a lot of people on the island, knew the island very well. I had sat in on a lot of domino games, and you know, I knew the whole thing with dominoes and how important it is down there. And she said, well, I'm getting ready to go down there to meet with the money people, the financier and the executive producer, and I'll tell them about our phone call. I said, okay, cool. So that was about, I think, a Monday or a Tuesday. Thursday morning, I'm in the shower and the phone rings. My wife answers the phone and she said, it's Lisa Cortez calling from Curacao. I said, oh, so I'm dripping wet and I'm on the phone and she says, Ernest, hi, I'm sitting here in the conference room, you know, in the boardroom with the executive producer and his lawyers and everybody. And I told them all about you. And can you fly down here tomorrow? And I said, yeah. Checked my wife, said, yeah. So, you know, they had a ticket, a first class ticket waiting for me to fly me from L.A. to Miami, then from Miami to Curacao, which, you know, from Miami, the flight to Curacao was 2.5 hours. And so when I got there, Curacao was in the middle of its third international film festival, which was quite impressive. That's when the deal was made. And we decided that, you know, we were going to do some slight rewriting on the script. Before I went down, Lisa had actually sent me an email copy of the book. So flying from L.A. to Miami and then Miami to Curacao, I had a chance to read about 3/4 of the novel. So I had a good idea of some of the changes, you know, that I wanted to make, put more of the novel into the screenplay. And so we did, and we were able to pull it together. We shot it in 2015. I was in Curacao from October until January of 2016.
Well, not a bad way to spend the fall and winter.
No. I mean, it was a difficult film to pull together because there isn't a real infrastructure for filmmaking there. Everything had to be bought in. There are some people there with film experience who live on the island because there have been, you know, they do some commercials there. They do some music videos there. There have been some feature films that have come to the island to shoot. There had been a film that had been there a couple of years before us about the big slave rebellion on the island. But everything had to be bought in. The equipment, everything had to be bought in. The department heads, you know, were from all over the place. It was a true international production. You know, I'm from the States. Lisa's from the States. A lot of the producers are from the States. The executive producer is from Curacao. My cinematographer was from Mexico. My sound mixer was from Montreal. A lot of the camera crew was from Mexico. A lot of the grip and electric crew came from the States. The cast was from America, from Britain, and from Sweden. So it was a real international production, and it's a film that we're proud of. We pulled it together, and it's a beautiful little movie.
Oh. And just one or two more quick things. I could talk to you forever, but I don't want to take up your whole day. Give us a quick rundown of what is on the Blu-ray of Juice.
It's a complete remastering of the film. The film has been mastered for high def. I supervised the transfer into 4K and did some image adjustment. Plus, there's a whole wealth of extras. There's an extended EPK behind the scenes of me directing the guys. And there's interviews with the actors. There's new interviews with Khalil and Jermaine and Omar and myself. Kind of like a great interview with Hank and Keith Shockley.
Hank and Keith Shockley of the famed Bomb Squad production crew did the music for Juice. Keith was a guest of The Cipher on episode 156.
Because what was amazing, because it was a labor of love. My wife has really been pushing to try and do this for the last 5 years. She first tried to do this for the 20th anniversary of Juice, but couldn't get anybody interested. So she pushed and pushed and pushed. And it has been a 5-year-long journey. And it's really, I think it's really going to pay off because we were able to find a lot of publicity materials, EPK stuff, interviews from back in the day that have not been seen by anybody. And seeing the one interview with the four guys together, the four actors together, and a young Tupac, and to see them interacting with each other and bouncing off each other is so much fun, and it's gold. It's pure D gold. And so it's an extensive making of.
Excellent. And I'm sure it's incredible. One last thing. School Days has a pretty famous scene where the Alpha Phi Alpha guys come in and do a step routine to one of their famous chants about being cool, right? The ice baby.
Ice baby, the black and gold.
How did you feel when maybe 3 years later, this guy comes out with a song that uses rips that off for the hook?
Well, I mean, you know, that was the actual, you know, I figured that he got it from our film. I said, oh, he saw School Days. but I think he's more ripping off Alpha Phi Alpha, probably, you know, because if you know, that came from them, because those guys really, you know, they, none of what they did was scripted. That all was them doing their marches, doing their own routines that they had been doing. So that was their stuff. But I figured, yeah, he saw School Days and made a song out of it. So, yeah,
definitely.
Which, it's called the sincerest form of flattery, right?
Definitely. Well, Ernest Dickerson, thank you so much. We could talk to you for hours. There's so much we didn't even hit on. Hopefully we will have an occasion to have you back very soon.
I'd love to do it again.
When Lisa Cortez approached me and asked me if I wanted to interview Ernest, I hardly let her finish the sentence before I said yes. But it wasn't until I started preparing for this interview and really dug into what he's done that his legacy hit me. The Spike Lee films that Ernest shot are marvels for a lot of reasons, but visually, they are all absolutely stunning. What he does with composition, color, and visual storytelling in those movies is incredible, and is a large part of the reason they are so well remembered decades later. And while plenty has been said about Juice over the years, I think here is perhaps the only place you'll get such a complete picture of the movie's history and of its influences. I was also incredibly excited to be able to talk to Ernest about his work in horror, his time with John Sayles and Bruce Springsteen, and, well, pretty much everything else we discussed. I hope you've enjoyed this episode at least as much as we enjoyed putting it together. Join us next week when our guest will be Nana Ashhurst, former president of Def Jam. Nana started out working at the label as an assistant in the 1980s, but within a few years had moved up the ranks. She also oversaw Russell Simmons' ventures into comedy, fashion, movies, and more. Tune in for all that, plus some great stories about Malcolm X, helping to run a revolution, and what it was like to see gangster rap take over the industry. Hers is an unheard story you won't want to miss. To make sure you hear each episode of The Cypher as soon as it comes out, subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app of choice. That's a good opportunity to check out our back catalog. If you like this episode, you should listen to our talk with Lisa Cortez about her two lives in the music and film worlds on episode 92. Whatever you use to listen to the show, Apple's podcast, Google Play, seriously, whatever, go now and give us a rating and a review. It helps us bring more fans and attention to the show. And you can really help us by becoming a patron. Visit us at patreon.com/thecyphershow and sign up. Bringing you a weekly show takes at least 20 hours a week. And we could really use the support. If even 20% of you gave us just a buck a month, we could at least afford to eat while researching and editing. As an added bonus for our patrons, every month we share audio that we get from our guests, either while talking to them after the main interview is over, or sometimes when they give us some extra special material. Join us by the end of June to have access to July's file. Previous months have included unreleased music from the likes of Wu-Tang and Chuck D. If you want to talk to us about the show, visit us on social media. We're at The Cypher Show on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Let us know what you thought of this episode and who you'd like to see on the show in the future. More information about anything related to the podcast, playlists, our complete archives, and more can be found for free at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sataro.
He was high all the time, no doubt about that.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
By the time I got there, there were usually about 4 or 5 dead rattlesnakes already laid out.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
I forgot about it. You know, I mean, it basically sat on the shelf.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
But to control it and use it as a storytelling tool, I think, is of paramount importance.
Our audio assistant is Rob Van Vranken.
I don't know what he's been doing recently, but I haven't seen him in a while.
Special thanks to Patreon supporter Jimmy Brantley.
But he was heavily drugged.
Extra special thanks to Ashley Blackwell of Graveyard Shift Sisters for letting me pick her brain.
She's going to be one of the first persons to go.
And to Nicole Solomon for her help, thoughts, and valuable suggestions.
Man, I grew up dreaming about this lady, and I get to kiss her.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
Yeah, he was on a steady diet of cocaine and high colonics.